soldier. I know that the clubs are weapons of war. I know that diamonds mean money for this art, but that's not the shape of my heart. That's not the shape of my heart.
This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, it's time to play a little bit of catch up. It's been a but also yesterday I recorded an interview with Thank you. And good morning. Well, it's been quite a while. It's actually been a month since I've been here. I was scheduled and planning to do an All Hallows Eve program, and I got ill. I had an ear infection, of all things, which I really must recommend to you. Don't do it. It's not a good idea. It hurts, and eventually, yeah, it went away, but sigh. Okay, so it's been 4 weeks. Yeah, 4 weeks since I've been on the air, 5 weeks since I've done a proper show, and we have a proper show for you this morning. Unfortunately, we've missed a number of movie openings that Dan Persons has done reviews for. We have two. He was going to have one this week, and he's had not feeling well issues this week, alas. So we have two for you, and I'm going to play them actually pretty much sequentially, one after the other. And why are they not showing up here? Do I have the order reversed? I'm still, as always, here we are. Yes, I have the order reversed. Always struggling with the technology here. But we heard The Martian during the thon, in fact, on the 15th, according to this. Okay, yeah, that figures. And this morning we will hear Crimson Peak and Crumbs. Crimson Peak you probably heard of. It's a film by Del Toro. Crumbs is, not a tentpole movie, not something that a studio is hoping to get all of their money from. And those are, frankly, a lot of the reviews that I like the most. I want to just throw in some quickies, since I don't do much media, but people know that I'm a bit of a Doctor Who fanatic, and have to say that this season of Doctor Who has been really good. And the episode that aired last Saturday with Peter Capaldi, he had what I think they would call his moment, like Chris Eccleston when in the first New Who series had his just this once everybody lives moment in the episode The Doctor Dances. They gave Peter Capaldi a brilliant anti-war speech. Coincidentally, just in time for Veterans Day. And that was his moment. May not be his last, but it was certainly one that said, okay, there is just no question that Peter Capaldi is a great Who. So, all that being... Oh, and the other thing. I saw the movie Tomorrowland. I've got a lot to say about it, and we don't have enough time. Dan did a review of that as well, which I somewhat agree with, but I liked it more than he did. And I do recommend it as it comes out onto various media that you can see at home. So, all that being said, let's get on to the two reviews and then an interview with John Joseph Adams. John, I'll do more of an intro at that time, but let's hear Dan's reviews.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. We're going to play 6 Degrees of Guillermo del Toro this time around, not just because his new film Crimson Peak came out a couple of weeks ago, but also because there are a few other notable releases that, just by coincidence, weirdly connect to him. As for Crimson Peak, del Toro's first attempt at telling an actual 19th-century Gothic ghost story, although pretty much all his works have some element of Gothic to them, yes, even when there are giant robots clomping around, There's a sequence at the beginning of the film when Tom Hiddleston, playing the passionate, mysterious aristocrat Thomas Sharp, teaches Mia Wasikowska, playing American heiress Edith Cushing, that newfangled dance craze, the waltz. He places a lit candle in their clutched hands, informing her that if the dance is done properly, the flame will not go out. Similarly, Crimson Peak is intended to be a waltz between all forms of Gothic storytelling, romantic, horror, mystery, ghost, even a few lashings of science fiction. Problem is, Del Toro keeps blowing the flame out. I'm beginning to fear that from his brief dalliance with The Hobbit that Del Toro has fallen prey to Peter Jackson syndrome, a debilitating affliction in which a director's inner editor is compromised and he begins to believe that more is indeed more, that he has license to throw up on the screen whatever his little old heart desires. In short, Del Toro should have picked one subgenre and stuck to it, rather than trying to cram them all in. And it's the ghost story, which is meant to be the most prominent, that suffers from this. It's never fully reconciled with straight melodramatic elements. In particular, the designs that Baronet Sharp and his sister, played by Jessica Chastain, have on poor Ms. Cushing turn out to be disappointingly prosaic and predictable, and no amount of paranormal intervention is able to fix that. Del Toro wants Hitchcock and Daphne du Maurier and Shirley Jackson and Arthur Conan Doyle and Robert Wise and a whole bunch of striking imagery, both real, like a gray mansion wreathed in a ring of startlingly crimson earth and computer-generated, to frolic in this grand goth playground. His zeal, as always, is infectious, but Crimson Peak doesn't quite pay it off. But if you do love Del Toro's enthusiasm, and who doesn't, really, you should know that he brings the same passion to his role as narrator of The Pit and the Pendulum, one of the segments of the new computer-animated Edgar Allan Poe anthology, Extraordinary Tales, that's opening this Friday. This is a collection of 5 short films inspired by Poe's works, all interpreted and helmed by Spanish director Raul Garcia and narrated by an eclectic collection of talent, including Christopher Lee in his last role, Julian Sands, even Bela Lugosi and Roger Corman get in there. Garcia is nothing if not ambitious. His interpretations take impressionistic liberties with the source material to good effect, and each film has its own unique style, from the stop-motion puppets of The Fall of the House of Usher to the monochromatic graphics based on the art of Alberto Breccia of The Telltale Heart, to the painterly lushness of The Mask of the Red Death. In terms of quality, the truly impressive pieces are backloaded toward the latter half of the collection, where both Red Death and Pendulum dwell. But my favorite may be The Facts in the Case of Mr. Valdemar, where 4-color graphic novel-like visuals make the tale of doctors who hold a patient between life and death suitably stark and indelibly creepy. There's another anthology getting its DVD release this Tuesday that hails back to Del Toro's original work in the country of his birth. Mexico Barbaro is a decidedly mixed bag. A lot of pieces favor style over narrative, and a few are little more than exercises in provocation, incorporating menstruation, demonic Roman showers, and underage necrophilia. Yep, I said it. Here again, the standouts are backloaded, particularly an energetically surreal tale of a man who steals a corpse from a morgue and resurrects it to fulfill a blood debt, and a very Robert Rodriguez-like vignette in which a group of prostitutes extract vengeance during Dia de los Muertos. The sum impression is outrageous at the very least, which is an honorable pursuit in itself, and sometimes much better, which I frankly prefer. And this last film's connection to Del Toro is tenuous at best, but it is from Brazil, and that's south of the U.S. like Mexico, and Portuguese does sound a lot like Spanish to my ear, so I'm going to go with that. Hard Labor, which opens this Friday, Gang's sardonic social commentary with what appears to be the first example of a darker incarnation of magic realism. Let's call it horror realism. As her husband, recently laid off from his job, struggles to adjust to the new realities of the job market, a woman opens up her own little grocery store and discovers that the mantle of management comes not only with ungrateful customers and larcenous employees, but with mysterious foul substances dripping from the walls and oozing up from the flooring, and intimations that the market's previous owners were contending with something that required iron chains and locked collars. The directors, Marco Dutra and Juliana Rojas, who also co-wrote, deliver an intriguingly low-key, enigmatic exercise. Maybe a little too low-key. I never really got the sense that the woman, Helena, played by Helena Albagaria, had much of a personal investment in the fate of her enterprise, which robs some of the impact from the revelation that she is, in fact, a pretty lousy boss. But all told, Hard Labor is an especially wicked survey of people struggling to cope with the new economic realities and the prices they have to pay to do so. And no child corpses get ravaged, so there's that too. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com. Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I'm a little conflicted here. By all rights, the new film Crumbs, which was released on home vid just this week, should be inspiring more passion in me. It is, after all, a curious little work set in a post-apocalyptic Ethiopia and filmed there, starring a disabled actor who has become a prominent celebrity in his home country, written and directed by a Spaniard, Miguel Lanzo, who is also a part-time resident in Ethiopia. That's one hell of a set of production notes there. That's enough to merit a look-see, at the very least. And let me note that I felt I was well rewarded for my curiosity. At the very least, the film is an odd, beguiling experience. But not a particularly intense one. It is a more quiet, surreal eulogy than a Mad Max struggle for survival, built around the premise that after a particularly devastating war, humanity has given up its will to live and reproduce. The stragglers pick among the ruins of a centuries-lost civilization, trading in old vinyl copies of Michael Jackson's Dangerous album and cheap plastic trinkets, a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle figurine, a toy sword, stuff like that. One of the scavengers, Candy, played by Daniel Tedesse, embarks on an odyssey to get seats for himself and his lover Sayat, played by Salam Tesfaye, on a spaceship that has recently spontaneously powered up. He says he wants to return to his home planet. On his way, he seeks the help of a benevolent witch, a noble warrior, and an oblivious Santa Claus, and... okay, I got this far in the synopsis, and I realized I haven't quite conveyed that it's a lost cause treating this as a straight narrative. Director Lanzo is out for a more surreal, impressionistic experience. He may or may not be taking his tip from filmmakers like Terry Gilliam and Richard Lester. Crumbs does seem to parallel Lester's The Bed Sitting Room in its post-apocalyptic humor. But the film is its own beast, a gentler, more low-key adventure resting on Tedesse's vulnerable performance and pulling significant atmosphere from its ravaged locations. Sadness, rather than rage, drives its story. There's a lot of weird stuff for weird stuff's sake. One of Candy's adversaries dresses in a Nazi uniform, gas mask, and Mickey Mouse ears. Santa Claus peddles toys no one wants, and despite the fact that Santa is a hike many days away for Candy, the emaciated old elf also communicates with Sayat via the ball return of the abandoned bowling alley where she lives. That ball return also randomly spits out bowling balls and other items may serve as some sort of observation of humanity's innate desire to perpetuate the species even despite itself, but I may be reading too much into that. Sometimes a bowling ball is just a bowling ball. Be sure to return your shoes before leaving. Crumbs doesn't burn its world into your memory, but it does insinuate itself through inventive mise-en-scene and wry humor. No adrenaline rush, to be sure, but a rewarding experience, nevertheless. I'm Dan Persons. We have a new episode of our Bad Movie Podcast, Temple of Bad, now available at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, taking on the goofy Mexican horror movie, The Brainiac. Check it out by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
All righty, and thank you, Dan. So, I just realized my interview with John Joseph Adams runs about 70 minutes. It is unexpurgated. I have not edited it. The interview only occurred yesterday, sort of here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, but we're on the third floor with WBAI. This was, in fact, on the ground floor of the Brooklyn Commons, where we held a wonderful reading with John's new book that he'll talk plenty about with Seanan McGuire and Carmen Maria Machado as our performers last night. And if you want to catch that, by the way, you can watch it. It's on live stream. You go to livestream.com, I'm pretty sure, and ain't.org, and you choose the, you know, there's broadcast or watch you want to watch, and then you do a search. And you do a search for NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction, NYRSF. And actually, you'll see a bunch of readings there, but last night's reading is a nice one, and you'll see an icon for the best American science fiction and fantasy, which is a book from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Well, we'll be talking a lot about that book in the interview, and since it runs, if I start it right now, pretty much to the end of the show, let's get going. By way of disclosure, by the way, John is somebody who's been on the show many times. He moved to California about 5 years ago, and for about the last 2.5 years, I have been working for him as the editor of the podcasts of two of his magazines, Lightspeed Magazine, which won the Hugo Award for Best Semi-Prose in the last 2 years, and Nightmare Magazine, which comes out biweekly. And I am the host of Lightspeed, which is a lot of fun. And, well, we'll talk about it more as we did yesterday. So let's set. Oh, it's loud, okay? I mean, the background is loud. The latte machine goes on in the beginning, and then it sort of quiets down. But it's just an in-situ, unedited, but perfectly listenable broadcast. Enjoy. Okay, so we begin by slating, as always, because I check out my recordings, and I always forget the date and the time, but it's a Tuesday afternoon in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe. And it's November 10th of 2015. And for the first time in a long time on Hour of the Wolf, with me is John Joseph Adams. And, ooh, that's cool. Every time somebody orders a latte. Now, the problem is BAI is no less soundproof than this. And people are only a little less disruptive. But you were a New Yorker. You're very much a part of the New York science fiction scene. And then sort of just upped to California, got married, opened magazines, started podcasts. So at this point, well, I actually printed out your credits and have them, because this is before the interview tonight. You know, all this noise didn't begin until we started recording. Yeah. I just wanted listeners to know that. Okay, so we'll say what the main event is that you're in town for. But your most recent anthologies include Wastelands, The Living Dead, Brave New Worlds, Operation Arcana, Press Start to Play, and The Apocalypse Triptych. And you're also publisher of Women Destroy Science Fiction, which is that a physical book? I know it's a physical audio book because I got to work on it. And
And perhaps most prestigiously is from the Best American Series, from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I never, for years I've been saying Houghton Mifflin.
Yeah, it is Houghton.
It is Houghton?
Yeah, Houghton. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Houghton, okay, yeah. So I've been saying it.
Houghton is right.
Okay, so Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I didn't even know about the Harcourt until now, and Best American Series I've always known about.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's big prestige.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they choose an editor, and the editor stays with the series, and then each year chooses a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first edition is out just now. And you chose Joe Hill,
mm-hmm.
who I can never say the name without thinking, I dreamed I saw him last night. Old Lefty song, for those who don't know.
Right.
Joe Hill is one of the most notable names in horror, and he did it all on his own.
What do you mean?
He never used... Well, what's his born name?
Oh, you mean he made his name all on his own?
He made his name all on his own.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, totally. I thought you were saying, like, oh, he edited Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy all on his own. Like, well, not quite.
No. I mean, he made his name and reputation.
Yeah, sure.
Without saying that his father is probably the best-selling horror writer mm-hmm. of all time, Stephen King.
Right. Yeah, and actually, you know, I used to work at the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and at the time, I was an assistant editor, so I was, you know, reading Slush, and Joe Hill was just submitting his first stories, and I could have discovered him, you know, because the stories came in, and I mean, I didn't reject them. I said, hey, this is good, and I'm passing it up.
So you passed them to Gordon.
Yeah, I passed it up, and I kept passing them up, and Gordon kept, I don't know what he didn't like about them, because I mean, a lot of those early stories, like I look back at them and I think they're amazing.
I don't think that Gordon is as big on horror as
FNSF always did actually publish quite a bit of horror to the extent that like I often thought like, well, they should really add horror to the name of the magazine because like it's fantasy and science fiction, and so people pick it up and they don't expect to get horror, and turns out that they actually do have quite a lot of it.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, you know, maybe. Probably not as much as I do.
I think Gordon, well, you know, changes with each editor.
Yeah.
So it probably had a certain amount with Ed Furman.
Right.
And...
Yeah.
Gordon, yeah, he did a fair amount. God knows that he is one of the most macabre minds that I know.
Right. Well, because, you know, it's like he discovered, like, Laird Barron and John Langan and... And I mean, aside from people he discovered like that, there's other writers that I remember being in the pages that were, you know, clearly horror writers, like, you know, Michael Shea and, you know, people like that. So, you know, so it surprised me, but, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, that's how the game goes, you know. It's everybody has different tastes, and, you know, I'm glad somebody, found Joe's stuff and promoted it and got it going. And, yeah, I mean, he's like, he did that sort of dream thing that I think writers, you know, aim for, is like, you know, he was able to establish his reputation on the short fiction, make a big deal about himself because of all that, like his collection, you know, like these stories were getting nominated for awards and reprinted and stuff, and then his collection came out and is getting nominated for awards and stuff, and all that without any indication of, like, you know, who his parentage was.
His heritage.
So, I mean, it was so great that he was able to do that.
I think it's a brave, smart thing, because, I mean, it wouldn't be any guarantee that somebody might buy a story.
Right.
But it's definitely a guarantee that it'll always get past the slush pile and say, my father's blah, blah. And yeah, there are probably some editors who would have bought it just to say, son of. So I think it's so smart and brave and brilliant is a good word on his part to have gone that route.
Right.
How well did you know him before you started...
I didn't know him very well at all. You know, I had never met him. I only just met him actually literally yesterday. We did an event at Forbidden Planet, and that's when I first met him.
Otherwise, just virtually.
Yeah, and I mean, even then, I mean, I didn't know him particularly well. It's like, you know, once we started working on Best American, you know, we exchanged emails and stuff, and so I got to know him a little bit over the course of the process, but, you know, we didn't really have, like, deep conversations about things and stuff. It was just really, you know, talking about the works that we were dealing with, and, And we were largely both working in a vacuum to some extent, because you know, the way this series works is that, you know, I try to read everything in that is published, you know, several thousand stories.
Yeah, you and Datlow,
yeah.
I think, are, I'm sure the other people, mm-hmm. but I don't know them. I've never met Paula Garan or help me, Jonathan Strahan.
Oh, Jonathan Strahan.
Rich Horton, Gardner who also works with you on Lightspeed.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, it's funny. It's like I always, like Gardner Dozois, like, you know, he does Year's Best Science Fiction, and he always ends up having like some honorable mentions of stories that are fantasy, or at least he indicates that he reads fantasy. I'm like, why are you even reading the fantasy? It's like, you don't need to. I mean, I guess he just wants to.
Because he writes it.
Well, I know, but I mean, it's like, but seriously, like, there is so much to read. Like, I mean, any excuse you get to not have to read something, like, that's... Thank you, you know, because I have to try to read everything, but
I don't see how that's possible. Really to read everything.
Oh, no. I mean, no, of course not. And you know, so, but I mean, I try to read as much as I can. I have some helpers who like help me read through, like, essentially slush read certain magazines where sort of like smaller venues and things like the, you know, that I've looked at before, and I know that it's probably kind of unlikely that something will come out of there, but I want to make sure that they get looked at, and that way, if anything really notable happens to end up in one of those, you know, maybe I'll find out about it. And the thing is, like, I also really pay close attention to social media, so if something really good ends up in a smaller venue, like, people will talk about it, and it sort of, and you know, somebody somewhere will read it, and they'll follow the link, and then they'll tweet about it or whatever. And so, like, the more I hear about a story, the more I'm like, oh, okay, maybe that's something to look at. And actually, one of those ended up in the book. There's a story by A. Mark Rustad called "How to Become a Robot in 12 Easy Steps." Or I don't know, I can't remember if "easy" is in the title, but anyway, that's the story.
I've got the arc in my bag. I can.
No, I'm sure it's close enough. and it was in this little magazine called Scigentacy, and it's like science. It's like science fiction and fantasy stories about gender. And like, I think I had heard of it, but I'm not actually sure until I heard about that story. And so I was just really pleased to have, you know, discovered that because people were talking about it, and so that's all part of it. But anyway, I was saying I try to read everything that I can, and then I come up with a list. So, you know, several thousand stories, I narrow it down to a list of 80. And, you know, in this case, I did 40 science fiction and 40 fantasy because I wanted it to be equal representation of both genres so that the title actually makes sense, where it's like, it says both in the title, I want you to get both in the book. And so I picked the 80 stories, and then I gave those 80 stories to Joe Hill, and all of the information was stripped off of them except for the title and the story. So, like, he didn't know who wrote them, he didn't know where they were published, and so he got to read them just in
evaluate
them.
And given the way he made his career, he should appreciate
that. Yeah, no, that's totally true. I didn't even think about that, actually. Yeah. But, I mean, and that wasn't, like, my idea or anything. That's just how the Best American series is set up. I thought that was really interesting because, you know, it was, like, really kind of a good barometer. It was like, well, what kind of reader are you? Like, you, and like, you know, if I was him, I would be like, oh, like, I can examine if I have any sort of unconscious biases or anything. It's like, well, if you look at the table of contents of this thing, it's like, I think Joe's pretty well balanced. It's like, I mean, he picked all different types of stories from all different types of writers, and you know, it's like the book's very diverse, and both on, you know, on gender lines, on race lines, on sexual preferences lines. So you know, there's queer writers, there's, you know, men, women, you know, people of color. So you know, it's yeah, I mean, it's great, you know, because it's like, I mean, I think that kind of thing is important, and I'm glad that, you know, just on the first go, it's like, you know, his top 20 that he picked, and he had to, and again, he had to pick 10 science fiction and 10 fantasy, so half and half. And just on the first go, it's like, dude, you nailed it. Nice job.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And it's interesting that he didn't veer too far into the only dark.
Right.
Given that he's primarily a horror writer.
Yeah. It probably does skew a little bit darker than most volumes would.
As do your tastes.
That's true, yeah. I seeded his selection pool with enough darker stuff that he could...
Yeah, but 80 is pretty diverse.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it wasn't all dark.
No, of course not. Yeah, actually, you know, one thing that I was kind of bummed about, when I really... So we're just launching this series, and, you know, Houghton Mifflin is, like, sort of an experimental and progressive publisher, and so... you know, I said, well, hey, okay, so how about we do Best American Science Fiction Fantasy? We publish that as usual, but then we also release an ebook only volume of the rest of the stories that didn't make it into the book.
Right.
You know,
this is WBAI in New York.
You know, so do like, you know, sort of the notable stories. And so there's so many you'd probably want to do one for science fiction, one for fantasy, two like separate ones so that you could keep the price point down on the ebooks and everything. And it just seemed like a no-brainer to me. And they didn't want to try it, but maybe I can convince them down the road, because I was like, well, no, like I understand. It's like it'll cost more money, but like, but look, if you give me
a
budget.
Yeah, but it might make more money.
Right, exactly. So. I was like, well, if you give me a budget of this amount, I think I could probably do it. And it's like, oh, well, then we have to go out and get permission. Well, you know, if you just let me do it, I'll do it. You know, like,
yeah.
I know all these people, you know. I mean, it's you know, I've edited, you know, like 2 dozen anthologies. I have too much of a problem, like, getting, you know. There was always issues, like, you know, some there's at least one author in the notable list who's repped by the Wiley agency, and it's like, and they're like the most powerful like literary agency in the world, and like they represent like, you know, mega stars and stuff, and so it's like they would probably be difficult to get the rights for, maybe, but you know, although I have dealt with them before and it worked, so,
and
you know,
and you never know.
Yeah,
you never know.
Yeah. And no disrespect to them, they're just doing their job and they're just good at it, you know, they're really good at it, so, you know, but I mean, you know, I think it would have been a cool thing, because I think people who are really passionate about short fiction, or even if they just read the book and they think it's fantastic and they want to get more, you know, that would be an easy way for them to get more. Instead, they're going to like have to go hunt down all these stories and stuff, you know. And I mean, you know, the back of the book does tell you where they appeared, so you could.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, it would be kind of a big project to do it on your own.
In fact, somebody recently mentioned in the question that always comes up at panels on my radio show, wherever, is how do you determine what is good science fiction, or, you know, when you haven't read this stuff? And
right.
I said, always get the best of the years and read them.
Right.
And if you like the name, then look for that name. And somebody else came up with an idea that I'd never heard before and was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
It was, and in that same book, take a look where the stories are coming from.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you notice that 20 of the stories are coming from Lightspeed, 20 of them from Clark's World, and all that, then you know that if you go get Lightspeed, Dark Nightmare, Clark's World, whichever, that's a good place to go as a bird dog to try and find stuff that you will like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's actually one of the things I really liked about the format of the Best American series, and you know, they've done this on other volumes. I don't think they do. I don't know if they do it in every single one, but I know, like in Best American Mysteries, which we're largely basing my, you know, this volume on, because it's also a genre one. But like, you know, in the table of contents, it tells you right there in the table of contents where that story came from, and on the first page of the story, it tells you right there, you know, where the story came from. And a lot of the year's best anthologies don't do that. Like, they might say it in the header note, but you have to like read through the header note to find it, or else maybe it doesn't even say it there. It just says it on the copyright page.
Yeah, and the copyright page is what I always used to have to turn to.
Right, and so it always does say it there. Although actually, some of the David Hartwell year's best didn't actually say it there. It just said like reprinted by permission of the author. It didn't say where it appeared, but not everybody knows to do that. Like, you know, we're like industry people, like we know to do that, but not like, I mean, the regular reader, they might not think to look at the copyright page. Like, before you got in, you know, did anything in publishing, did you ever like think like, oh, I should look at the copyright page to see where these stories appeared? You know, I mean, maybe you stumble across it and then you're like, aha. But you know, it's if you just put it in the actual part of the book that you expect people to read, that makes more sense. You know, this kind of goes hand in hand for me, like with author bios and stuff, like in anthologies. And in the case of Best American, they're all in the back, which is not actually my preference. But because what I always figure, it's like if you read a story and you think it's amazing, you get to the end of it, you know, maybe you take a little breath and you're like, you know, enjoy that feeling of reading a story. At that moment, that's the best time for you to read the author's bio and find out who this amazing person is that just wrote that story that moved you
that
way.
It's the best afterword you can possibly get.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, you could put it in the front, like, and so, like, people browsing through the book can be like, oh, that person sounds interesting, I'm going to read that. But I think it's much better to just have it right at the end, because then you get the, you know, like, you're more likely to be like, hey, what else has this person done? I know. I'm
also,
gonna go check
where
that
did
out.
That story come from?
Exactly.
I love that story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What is there?
Yeah.
You know, is that person a doctor?
Right.
Might
exactly.
Explain
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something about.
Yeah. Yeah, so like, you know,
the story itself.
Yeah, like when I do Lightspeed, you know, the issues of Lightspeed, we always have the bios right at the end, and so that's always made sense to me. And I always try to do it in my anthologies whenever we can.
Except in the podcast, we
that's
put
true.
It
we do it the
right
front.
Up front.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Maybe we should put it at the back. I don't know.
Maybe we should.
Yeah, and it would get to the story faster, and I think that's always a good thing. You know.
Oh well, yeah. I edit the podcast. Oh,
right.
I host. Wait.
You host.
I forgot.
Yeah.
I'm the host for Lightspeed. Justice Jack Kincaid is the host for Nightmare. I do the editing for Nightmare, but I host for Lightspeed, which is a lot of fun, I must say. I've been doing it now all over 2 years.
Yeah, a long time now.
I can. It's a great showcase for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad you're doing it. I mean, it's so great to be able to find somebody like with your experience to be able to do something like this for us.
Yeah, well, I was amazed when I got an email from you saying, Jim, do you know how to edit audio?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I learned with Bert Searles and Samuel R. Delaney
in
1967.
Well, I meant more like digital audio. You know, obviously, I knew you knew how to do the other kind of editing.
Because nowadays the radio show is sent digitally.
Right.
And so I didn't have a lot. I mean, now I dare say I'm one of the most experienced people out there because I'm doing three stories.
Yeah.
Every 2 weeks, just for you.
Yeah.
And now I'm getting additional work, mostly from Skyboat Media, who produce the podcast for you. And boy, are they great!
Yeah.
And so I'm hardly away from the digital editing. I've gotten very good on the digital side. But, you know, I could go into a whole long tirade. And I did, when Stefan was last in town, I did a show with him talking about how old-time people, like myself, who learned how to literally hurt our fingers with razor blades as we are cutting tape, we edit differently than the whippersnappers who've learned in audio in digital. And there are things that they can do in digital that I learn from. I go, oh my God, that's a great idea. And I've learned tricks.
Yeah.
But I know tricks they don't. The always grab room tone. Whenever the room tone changes, do that. And I think when I edit, when you talk about somebody editing a movie, like Thelma, what's her name? Scorsese's editor. She, you know, wins the Academy Award every year. She edits one of his films.
Right.
She determines the timing, the pace of the film. It's not just how many takes were there.
Right.
So there's something to it. But anyhow, I'm getting off topic for the moment. Getting back to, we were talking earlier about your years at FNSF. I was almost struck when you left.
Yeah.
Because you had been there, what, 5 years?
Oh, no, like almost 9 years.
9 years.
Yeah, like it was like 8.5 years. So I started off as an editorial assistant, and then I ended as an assistant editor. And, I mean, mainly it was just like I just got more responsibilities as I went along, you know, and you know, got raises or whatever. But, you know, I mean, small ones.
Yeah.
But, you know.
When we're talking presses like that.
Right.
That's all there is.
Yeah. Although, strangely enough, as small as my raises were as I proceeded along, when I actually left to edit Lightspeed, you know, I was going from an assistant editor at FNSF to being the editor of Lightspeed, you know, the main editor, and I actually had to take a significant pay cut because, again, it was like
it was also an entrepreneurial stuff.
Right, true, but you know, it's like it was a going from FNSF, which is you know. Is a small press, but is a very long established publication to a new publication that was being published by a more recent publisher.
Like, I mean, it's the same thing in tech. It's like leaving a major company to do a startup.
Right. Yeah.
You're taking a risk.
Yeah.
But if it pays off, you're now at the top of the heap with your own imprint.
Yeah. Yeah, and surely, you know, I couldn't be doing Best American or almost anything else that I've done in my career if I hadn't done Lightspeed. You know, it's like, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say totally because, like, I did my first couple anthologies before Lightspeed, and actually those actually paved the way to make Lightspeed even happen.
Wastelands sort of started that off.
Yeah, Wastelands and then Living Dead. Yeah, so, I mean, the combination, it's like, it's kind of crazy if you look back It's like 2008. Wastelands comes out in January. The Living Dead comes out in like September, and it's like, and those are like two of my first three anthologies, and it's like they were like just like huge. And it's funny, and somebody had told
me the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings did the launch of Living Dead.
Right, that's right, yeah. And actually, I met
the Seaport.
Yeah, and I actually met one of my great friends there, Jordan Hammersley, and who's now also an editor. And she initially came on and helped me with Lightspeed right at the start. She was like one of my first assistant editors. I think she was the first assistant editor. But now she's an editor of books and such, and she's working for Adaptive Books at the moment. But she was at Penguin and Gross and Dunlap and such. So it's funny with when The Living Dead came out, people sold really well, and it's sort of like. People have said this, and like I don't want to claim credit for it, but like a lot of people have said, like it's sort of revitalized the anthology market, and like I certainly saw a lot of people also saying, hey, we should do a zombie anthology too, and I saw a lot more anthology since then, but people would say like hey, so that was great that you did that Living Dead, but don't ever expect any of your other books to sell that well, and so far they've been pretty right, although Wastelands might actually catch up to it. Because the
first Wasteland?
Yeah, because like the long tail there on Wasteland seems like it's better than The Living Dead. Like The Living Dead, well, I think The Living Dead has had more competition. There's been more zombie stuff come out and is drawing the attention away from The Living Dead.
And The Walking Dead,
sure.
No doubt, has helped.
Yeah, I mean, I would have thought, sales
on anything zombie to begin with.
Right. And then with Wastelands, though, like we actually just released... Yeah.
Yeah, well, no, go on.
Oh. I was going to say, we just released the mass market paperback this year, and it was like one of the best-selling books that the publisher put out.
And still doing.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
and Wastelands 2 is out now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so Titan Books released Wastelands 2 earlier this year, and then they also released Wastelands 1 in mass market right around the same time.
Yeah.
And so, but even though Wastelands 2 had never been seen before, Wastelands 1 in mass market is actually just setting the world on fire over there, so... I didn't actually mean that pun, but it works.
But it comes to the question that I'm going to ask.
Yeah.
It's a social question,
yeah.
But one that you're in at the heart of. Mm-hmm. WTF, what the hell is it about apocalyptic science fiction that, you have published of all the books you have published, not to mention stories.
Right.
Aside from two Wastelands books,
right.
You also have The End Is Near, The End Is Nigh, The End Is Now.
Right.
The
Living Dead and Living Dead 2 are both also kind of apocalyptic, because zombie anthologies tend to be kind of apocalyptic. Robot Uprisings is kind of apocalyptic. There's Brave New World, which is dystopian, but it's kind of like in the same vein to some degree,
So,
science
fiction and fantasy as a genre went from being a Cassandra-like literature, where it was warning of the future, to being a totally optimistic, oh my God, the Hugo Gernsback, we can rocket jockey, everything that Tomorrowland, the movie, tried to be about, which is partly why Tomorrowland flopped, I think.
Right.
Because people didn't want that message of hope, which is what the message in Tomorrowland is.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the darkest of the dark, I think 9/11 helped a lot to make this stuff so dark.
Yeah.
Why are people embracing the Game of Thrones?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love George Martin as a writer.
Yeah.
But I have to say that, now I'm forgetting the name of the book, Fire and Ice, is it?
Song of Ice and Fire,
Songs of Ice and Fire. And I cannot watch the TV show.
Yeah, well, it's very visceral.
That's the right word.
Yeah.
I don't mind violence.
Mm-hmm.
I can watch violence. And serves a story and all that. But to see when, not just somebody getting hit with a sword, but arterial spout, a close-up.
Yeah.
I think that was episode 6. I quit at episode 8
of
the first series.
Right, right.
Because I just could not watch it. I had too many nightmares. Almost everything has gone completely dark.
Yeah.
And your anthologies are right at the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I won't say at the heart of the darkness, if you will, but you very much reflect, I think, the Weltanschauung that society currently has. You're right on the cutting edge of that.
Mm-hmm.
And did you foresee that? Is that simply where you are? And why has the world gone so dark?
Well, I mean...
it is 15 years after 9/11.
Right, no, I know. I mean, I first started seeing, like, the sort of resurgence of apocalyptic fiction shortly after 9/11. You know, I was reading The Slush Pile at FNSF, and I think The Slush Pile is a great place to sort of see what trends are developing, see what sort of anxieties or fears are on the minds of writers, or even, not even just anxieties and fears, but, you know, just things that are preoccupying them, whether it's good or bad. So, you know, it took publishing a long time to actually catch on that this was a thing happening again, because, you know, post-apocalyptic fiction had been very popular, you know, in, you know, all the way up and through the 90s, and then when the Cold War ended, it sort of all went away. I think we sort of was like, oh, okay, well, that the whole world ending is thing isn't going to happen, and so we can relax, and we stop worrying about it. And then 9/11 came along and reminded us that, well, oh, actually, you know, scary stuff like that can still happen.
And right now it's getting worse again, because our politics with both Russia and China again are getting brinkmanship type stuff, with proxy war instead of Vietnam.
Right.
Now it's in Syria.
Yeah.
So we've got proxy wars going on again with economic warfare, and this time it's technological.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am of the firm belief that we are already totally, and this is only in my head, but I don't think it's only in my head, because who is it? Ted Koppel just put out a book, of all things, about the technology wars that we may or may not be prepared for. We don't know how much we are armed.
Mm-hmm.
But there's cyber war going on. We have certainly seen what happened to Sony.
Yeah.
For example.
Right.
Allegedly, from a country of what we used to call the Iron Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's yet another scale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting that it's a scale and a thing that science fiction was dealing with, what is now considered passé, cyberpunk.
Mm-hmm.
Although we're still getting stories, wouldn't you say? You published We Are the Cloud by Sanjay Miller.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a neo-cyberpunk, yeah.
Oh, I said very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
Or post-cyberpunk.
Yeah, post-cyberpunk,
that might be a better way to put it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, John Kessel and James Patrick Kelly actually did a whole anthology of post-cyberpunk stories, and that was a couple of years ago now, even. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, about 6 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, somebody was talking to me about doing a cyberpunk anthology at some point, and it was, like, after they had done their post-cyberpunk, and I was like, I don't know that it's, like, I couldn't quite conceptualize it as being something that you could do. It's like, you would have to do it as post-cyberpunk, but somebody did end up doing one, but... But then Sam Miller's story came along, and it's like, well, but I mean, like you said, it's post-cyberpunk, but it's not really...
It's post-cyberpunk, but it's also totally contemporary.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at the point cyberpunk began was before the web.
Right.
It was not before the internet, but it was totally before the web.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the early 80s.
Yeah.
The web became commercialized, .com, in 1995.
Right. But speaking of, like, the technological war, it's I read this book called Future Crimes by Mark Goodman. I don't know if you've seen this book, but
I don't think so.
It's a nonfiction book, and it's actually one of the scariest things I've ever read, just because it's like because he's like a technology, like, criminologist or whatever. Like, you know, he worked with the police department on technological crimes, and it's just like this manual of, like, all of the horrible things that could go wrong with your technology, that the way criminals can take advantage of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, you know, from like, you know, I'm sitting in front of here, there's a USB port from the, you know, and it's like, by plugging your phone into this USB port, a criminal could hack this USB port and just get complete access to your, you know, your equipment.
Well,
and
how about your refrigerator?
Yeah, yeah.
Because the next coming thing is the Internet of Things, IoT.
Right, yeah, he talks about that all the time in there.
Yeah, and so it's wonderful that Google and possibly other companies are developing self-driving autonomous cars.
Right.
But they can be hacked.
Right, well, yeah.
Currently, they
have been. Yeah, I know they have been, yeah. Jeep got hacked, right? And so, I mean, that's terrifying, you know.
So imagine... You know, I don't think that these companies are inherently evil, but there's always going to be somebody, if not for an evil purpose, for a prank, there's always going to be somebody out there who's going to turn your light switches on and off and things like that. And this is now all controllable and connected to the internet.
Right. Oh, but, you know, so it occurs to me that it, as in speak, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, this is fodder for you, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, totally. And I was going to say, actually, speaking of technology and the apocalypse, you know, it feels appropriate to me that we're talking about it today, because today is the day Fallout 4 came out. And and actually, my interest in post-apocalyptic narratives was developed by Fallout, the Fallout series. You know, this is 4, so there's several of them before that. And the first ones were, like, in the 90s, And so there was a game called Wasteland that actually came before that, which is where I may have borrowed a title from. And then Fallout was kind of the spiritual successor, because, like, I don't know, they couldn't get the rights to make Wasteland 2. And now they actually did just recently make Wasteland 2, the video game.
Who puts that on?
Well, let's see. It was
probably today's everything is electronic. Arts,
I can't. Well, I can't remember what the original publisher of Wasteland was, but like now, Brian Fargo is a producer, and like he has In Exile Entertainment, so they kickstarted Wasteland 2, and so but In Exile is the publisher of that, and so Brian Fargo also though created Fallout, and so it's all sort of connected, but Fallout's like probably my favorite, like, you know, sort of media world franchise thing. And it's the 10th, and Fallout 4 came out, and I'm here in New York, and my Xbox is 3,000 miles away, and actually I have a lot of stuff to do though, so I don't even know if I'm allowed to play it when I get home, because it's like I gotta use it as a carrot or something. It's like, you know, best American Science Fiction Fantasy Volume 2, I still gotta come up with my list of 80 for that, like, and that's due, I think, at the end of February. And so
that's all.
And so at that point I have to give it to the guest editor, so it's like, okay, there's no margin for, you know, blowing that deadline.
Can you announce yet who the guest editor
is? I can't, alas. We have chosen the person, and we haven't announced it yet, but
it's an American writer.
So I was thinking I might be like, okay, well, I just have to wait to play it until I turn that in, because you know, it's gonna eat my life, you know.
Yeah, well, I you know, talk about eating your life. I don't know where you get the time.
You're right.
Let's just how many anthologies are you working on at this time?
I'm actually not working on that many right now. I'm only working on two anthologies at the moment.
Let's try it from a different angle. Right. How many do you have in print right now?
In print.
Can you count that, huh?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly. I mean, it's more than 2 dozen. And 6 came out this year.
Yes.
So,
okay,
I mean,
fine.
That's the ridiculous number. That's the ridiculous number.
Plus a month of 2 monthly magazines.
Right, exactly.
One of which has folded. Fantasy Magazine got folded into Lightspeed.
Yeah.
And every so often there'll be like a special edition.
Right. Yeah,
since I've been working for you.
Right.
There has been one edition of Fantasy for Women Destroy Fantasy.
Right, and now the Queers Destroy Fantasy is coming out in
December. Yes.
And so, yeah, we've done the
Rick Bowes won't let me forget that.
Yeah, we've done the special issues now the last 2 years, and so we, you know, started with Women Destroy, and then this year we did Queers Destroy, and we initially were just going to do, you know, Destroy Science Fiction, but then we did a Kickstarter, and we unlocked various stretch goals, including, so we decided, okay, we're going to go ahead and let Women Destroy Horror and also Destroy Fantasy, because we unlocked various stretch goals.
Right.
And so we did the same thing this year with the Queers Destroy project. And so
and next year's People of Color.
People of Color Destroy, right. And so Nello Hopkinson and Christine Ong Muslim are the guest editors for that one. I'd asked Nello Hopkinson.
And Nello is now West Coast.
Yes, exactly.
Came down
yeah.
from Canada.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, you know, I'd asked Nello to do it, and she said yes. And then she's like, well, you know what, though? I'd actually really like to mentor an up-and-coming sort of lesser-known editor and, you know, person of color. And she wanted to bring somebody from outside the United States. And so Christine is, I believe she's from the Philippines. And so, but she's certainly from that part of the world. And so Nello wanted to bring her on to co-edit with her. And of course, we have other section editors as well. Like, there's a different editor for the Flash Fiction section. There's a different different editor for the nonfiction section. And yeah, and if anybody's interested in any of the Destroy projects, they can go to destroysf.com. And if you go to destroysf.com/POC, it has info about the People of Color Destroy project.
Or for any and all of this stuff, johnjosephadams.com is a portal to all things John Joseph Adams.
Indeed, indeed.
Including the destruction of all these.
Yes.
Would you explain to listeners where the Destroy...
Sure.
Because it is... sort of antithetical to all these people who create.
Right.
But people love the term destroy because it is intended. It's like there was that whole era when people said, oh man, that's bad, meaning that's really good.
Right.
And so destroy here, just, but it came out of an ironic...
Right. Yeah, so there was a review that somebody was reviewing. I believe it was a Lois McMaster Bujold book, and he was just, and the guy was just sort of complaining that women were destroying science fiction by basically getting, like, you know, romantic elements and whatever, like, you know, that kind of thing. And it's just like bringing their femaleness into his masculine genre, and people were just rightly very upset by this, and you know, were grousing about it on the internet and on Twitter and such. And so after that happened, like the first day after that happened, my wife got up that day and she, you know, she got on Twitter. She's like,
"This is Christy Yant."
Yeah, Christy Yant. And so she says, "Hey, ladies, I feel like destroying science fiction today. Who's with me?" And that, like, was like a rallying cry. Like, so many people, like, retweeted that and, like, were replying, and they were like, "You have my sword." And
because by the time you do POC destroy SF.
Yeah.
POC DSF. Wow.
Yeah, that one's a mouthful.
That's a mouthful. Yeah, that really is.
That's a tough one.
By the time you do that, I wonder how many people will know. I think, in fact, a lot of the people who have embraced the Destroy series at this time don't know the derivation of where the phrase came from. And I loved grouse about it. I was telling you off air.
Yeah.
Just because... in this case, destroy means create.
Right.
That's precisely what it means.
Yeah.
And because this is a series that specifically goes beyond the mainstream, and it's ironic to discuss the mainstream of science fiction because those are supposed to be antithetical.
Right.
The science fiction shouldn't have a mainstream.
Right.
It really ought. Mm-hmm. So what you are doing is making sure that the perimeters are stretched, which is what, and when I say science fiction, I mean all of it.
Right. Fantasy as well,
Well, I use the Damon Knight definition.
Right.
It's always been attributed to Damon Knight.
Yeah.
And I believe he really is the person who said it. Science fiction is what I'm pointing
at. When I say science fiction or whatever. Yeah, I quoted that in the introduction to Best American. I was like, it's not...
That's right, you did,
It's like, it's not really a useful definition, but it's like, it is...
And David Hartwell wrote an essay called Why Science Fiction is the Wrong and Only Name for It.
Which
is... and that essay is like 20 years old, and it holds up.
Right.
It really does.
Yeah.
It's a good mark.
Mm-hmm.
So and all these terms change, but for right now you have pretty well coined something, ironically, which people have embraced without knowing the irony.
Right. You know, one of the things I like best about, like, the Destroy name or brand or whatever you want to call it. You know, that came out of that is in the sort of manifesto / introduction to Queers Destroy Science Fiction. The Flash Fiction editor Sigrid Ellis, she says something like, of course queers can't destroy science fiction. No one can, and I just love that. I love that notion. And you know, she goes on to talk more about that, you know, that sort of subject. But you know, and the thing is, it's like, you know. And a lot of the different editors have talked about this in various editorials. It's like, you know, well, it's like okay, well, you know, if we do destroy it, we're just going to destroy it and then build it back up better than it was before. Because, you know, sometimes that's what you do to make something new and better. You tear it down and you build it back up.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that science fiction needed to that level of work on it. But, I mean, maybe it did.
Actually, I would say it did.
Yeah, I mean, because there was a lot of sort of weird.
And the proof of that, we saw this year at WorldCon, because of the Hugo Awards, because there are lobby groups out there who want to cling to the 1940s,
right?
Pretty much,
yeah.
And to a very white male centric view of what science fiction is supposed to be.
Well, and it's just really interesting to me that, that anyone would think that anyone else would, like, be an editor and buy stories based on some agenda and not just because they really like them. It's like, how terrible would my job be? Like, how awful would it be to go to work and do everything that I do if I was just, like, if I had a checklist and I was just like, oh, yeah, okay, I found one of those, I found one of these, found one of that, and it wasn't like I didn't actually enjoy the stories. It's like, that would be maddening. You know, I mean, I don't know about you, but like if when I was in school and everything and I got assigned something and I didn't want to read it, that was the worst thing in the world.
Yeah.
Like I just can't. And
that
you
happened
know,
to me already in grade school when we were assigned a separate piece.
Right. By, I never had to read that, but
I was forced to.
Right.
And this was, I'm old enough that I was flunked for turning in a book report of The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury because science fiction isn't literature. I'm old enough to have had one teacher who was old-fashioned enough for that. And I'm losing track because that reminded me of my partner who went to school at SUNY Binghamton, who had a creative writing teacher who told her that science fiction, you know, couldn't be literature. At the same time, where at that school, Harper College, Joanna Russ was one of the teachers. You know, so a separate piece was a metaphor for apparently Judas and Jesus. And they didn't teach that in my synagogue. And why is this being taught to me? It's not relevant to my life. And I couldn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy it. It was torture. So I hid books within the... Also, I was a far faster reader, even in the fourth and fifth grade, than anybody else in my class. So I was always skipping ahead. Because I've read the book. I could repeat the book. That didn't mean I enjoyed it. But sorry, you were talking about the need to enjoy as an editor.
I mean, you know, there's no way I'd still be doing this, and like I wouldn't have. There's no way I would have edited, you know, 2 dozen anthologies, whatever, and like and subject myself to reading thousands of stories for Best American Science Fiction Fantasy. There's no way I would do that if reading all of those stories was torturous to me, or if like you know having to wait, or you know having to put the ones in the book that like are things I don't like. I mean, why would I want to do that to myself? It's like that.
And yet, it's funny because I recognize the quality of everything that you put out, and as the audio editor of which is I think exactly half of the output that you have, I find myself especially with speaking of some of the visceral. Horror that you've had by such wonderful writers. Who is it? I run into her all the time. Wonderful writer, great person. Very short hair. Ran into her at Bo Bolander's house not long ago. Bo now lives here in New York, in Brooklyn, as a matter of fact. And one of your regular writers.
I need more information. Genevieve Valentine?
No.
I mean, I figured you would know her.
I've known Genevieve. No, this isn't a New Yorker.
Oh, okay.
Also, this is somebody who lives in D.C.
Okay.
It's not Sarah Pinsker. It's, who's another wonderful human being at any rate. Somebody who I guarantee is going to be at this reading series. But when I read, listen to some of that work, and especially the audio. I sit there sometimes when I'm editing this cringing at the gore, because there's nothing worse than the mind's eye. And I don't have the stomach for visceral gore. And if it's bad for me to watch it on TV, it's worse for the mind's eye to create it. So I enjoy the stories because they somehow, despite all that, end up being really good literature.
Right, right, right.
They really work on many levels.
Yeah.
And so when it's done, it's there. But
yeah.
Were I an editor,
mm-hmm.
I probably wouldn't be choosing those.
Right. Well, you certainly wouldn't edit a horror magazine.
Well, exactly. Dark fantasy, yes.
Right, right, right.
But horror, not. Or if it were horror, it'd be more, you know, the Lovecraft, Poe-ish kind of horror, but not the visceral.
Right. You know, I feel like if I was Gordon Van Gelder, I would have known who you were talking about, because he like memorizes like people's addresses, like from seeing them on the manuscripts and stuff. And he'd be like, he'd do party tricks at cons, and like he'd meet somebody for the first time, and he'd like quote their address to them and like freak them out. But I never got that talent.
His memory is amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I asked him about a story that he rejected from my partner, like three, not about the story, but he hand wrote a story that you were still there. Had passed on to him that he then rejected with a handwritten rejection letter.
Right.
And I said, well, it's interesting what you wrote in the rejection letter, such and such. Mm-hmm. And he remembered the story, remembered details of the story.
You know, that...
How do you do that?
I almost kind of feel like that makes it harder to be an editor for a long term. Because, like, I think the better... Like, if you have such a good memory that you can, like, remember details like that... It's going to be so hard to impress you with a story, because you're going to feel like you've read everything and this reminds you of everything else. It's like, I'm like, my mind's like a sieve. It's like, or I'm like a goldfish, you know? It's like, I read a story and then like, I barely remember it. Like, you know, after a week or something. And you know, I mean, well, it's partially also because I'm consuming so much. You know, I mean, some things obviously stick in my head, but I mean, you know, I was a judge for the National Book Award this year for the Young People's Literature category, and that's actually why I'm in New York, because I have to go to the gala on the 18th, and we actually have to decide the winner on the 18th as well. But I mean, there's books I read there, like, okay, so I rate everything on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, and so like I got like Flowers for Algernon and like The Death Bird, like those are my 10 stories and like short stories, and like so I almost never give anything a 10, including most of the stuff I publish. It's like, I mean, it's gotta be like it's gonna be something that stays with me forever if I give it a 10, you know. And I read two books this year for the National Book Award that I gave a 10 to.
Wow.
And one of them is still in the running for the top prize here. And so it's like, I feel like that honestly is a book that I will remember and cherish forever. And
you're going to have to email me later to tell me what those were. It would be indiscreet to mention them now.
Right. I could tell you what one of them is, because it's not in the running anymore, but I can't tell you the other one because it's still in the running. So.
Yeah.
Also off air though. So
yes,
yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's just really, I mean, the more I read, the more it's like, yeah, I can't keep this all in my head. And I actually think it's kind of a good thing, because I can approach things fresh, because most readers won't have read all of that stuff.
Yeah. Right.
And I always kind of felt like, you know, there was a certain thing that happens to editors the longer they're around, is that, you know, you sort of get so sort of calcified against these sorts of things. It's like, oh, I've seen that, and you know.
Sorry, Sunny Moraine.
Yeah. Oh, Sunny Moraine. Okay. Yeah, I couldn't remember where. Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't
just
remember
going
where she
back
lived.
To,
yeah. Yeah.
I knew the name would come up at an inappropriate moment,
and
that was it.
Right. Not very sunny at all, turns out. I mean, very dark
and
gloomy.
But not as a person.
Right, no.
Have you met her?
No, I haven't.
She's wonderful.
Yeah.
She's absolutely wonderful. I see
Well, I mean, most horror writers are, right?
And we,
And they're all bubbly and happy and stuff.
Yeah.
Because you know, they get all the demons out.
Gamble's like the happiest person I've ever met.
They get all the demons out in the prose, man.
That's what I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's
Joe Hill was the same way, you know, just such a like lively personality.
I met his father. He's
exactly.
I met his father before I knew his father was, when Carrie came out.
Oh, really?
But I didn't
know.
We were at a con,
right?
And a bunch of people got into a car to go to a nearby bar and shoot pinball, and it was Fireball XL. I remembered the game, and he beat me, which was rare and unusual. I just knew there was this big guy named Steven, you know?
Right.
And when we got back, everybody was pushing copies of Carrie for him to autograph, and I'm going, So that's...
Right.
But, you know, talk about your friendly, open, sunny...
Right.
And he was already Stephen King.
Right.
He was already, you know, King of the Hill.
Right.
Oh, dear, that's terrible. King of the Hill.
Oh, that's...
Yeah, right? I'm sure son and father have come up with that.
Yeah.
They can't not have.
Right.
But the he doesn't stand on that pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
He never does. He still writes for fanzines.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know,
yeah, no, I mean, he's always been great, and like, you know, I feel like I owe a lot to him, largely because, like, you know, my first anthology, he allowed me to reprint a story, and it's like,
right.
Who the heck am I? You know, I mean, I actually did talk to him once on the phone. I've never met him.
He supports the field.
Yeah, but you know, he was a subscriber to FNSF, and so one time Gordon, like, he had subscribed, and Gordon had, and he had written on his check, like, you know, this is the best fiction magazine in America, and so Gordon had written to his people and said, hey, you know, we're doing a subscription drive, could we use that quote? And so Stephen King actually called to say yes, that it was okay, but Gordon wasn't there, so I had to take a message, and
how
that,
terrible. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but I mean, that was so bizarre for me, because I was sort of right at the height of my Stephen King fandom, because like I hadn't read a lot of it when I was younger, largely because like my former brother-in-law had sort of steered me away from him, because like I don't know, he was my sort of my advisor, but like he thought I wouldn't like it for whatever reason, but I did, and so I was just like, I was like in the middle of reading The Dark Tower, and so I was like, oh, I loved it so much, and so to talk to Stephen King right at that moment, I mean, for like 2 seconds, you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
that happened to me once, but for me, I was working on the Council of Elrond, and Baird Searles gave me a phone number to call in England to get the pronunciations of certain names.
No.
Yep.
Wow.
I spoke with Professor Tolkien.
Wow.
And, you know, for, you know, half a minute.
Yeah, oh my
goodness.
I'm
so pissed that I did not record that. But, yeah, I was actually on the phone with J.R.R. Tolkien about a year before his death.
Wow.
So,
that's incredible.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
How lucky was that?
I know. Oh, I'm going to tell my sister-in-law about that. She's going to freak out.
And in the horror world, I met Sonia Green.
Uh-huh.
Actually met her and interviewed her.
Mm-hmm.
Name doesn't ring a bell.
Mm-mm.
Mrs. H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Because it was his fellow who's only now becoming well-known after his death, alas, Willis Conover, who was Voice of America and a Lovecraft expert. And he knew all these people in the Lovecraft circle.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew the work that I and Margot Adler were doing at WBAI. And would just show up. He'd make a phone call. Are you free? Yeah, I'm free. Fine. And he'd just bring in, this is Manly Wade Wellman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. You know, Frank Belknap Long.
Right.
And these people from the Lovecraft circle.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he brings in this elderly woman, Sonia Green.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea who she was. She was married. And, didn't stay with him physically for long, stayed married all those years.
Uh-huh.
That was Mrs. Lovecraft.
Right.
And when I tell this to Lovecraftians, which I am not one of, their jaw drops.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Right.
But I love name dropping and all that.
Speaking of Lovecraft, actually, I forgot that there is another anthology technically I'm working on. I forgot. So for next year, Saga is going to publish a book called What the Blank Is That? And the blank is, you know, usually the F word, but it's like we have on the title, we have it bleeped out by Grolix, which is like symbols. Like Grolix comes from comics, if people don't know. It's like when they bleep out a word, but they use like a pound sign, a asterisk, an at symbol, you know. That
I
kind
never
of thing.
Knew. I use Grolix all the time.
Right.
I never knew what the word was.
Right. I know.
This
we didn't know either until we were trying to figure out what do you call it. And so so that actually started. It sort of inspired.
So the TV show should have been called Golix, my mother said. My
father said. Yeah. So it's. It was inspired by a meme, and there was this. So basically, there was a collection of H.P. Lovecraft's fiction, and it was like from Harper Perennial, and like Joyce Carol Oates had like written the introduction, or maybe she edited it. She may have selected them, and there was like a blurb from Stephen King on there, and then so somebody took the cover, and like I had like a Mike Mignola cover, and it was like just a crazy Lovecraft, you know, or crazy Cthulhu, and so somebody took the cover and they photoshopped out the titles and stuff, and they just called it What the F Is That, you know, and although they didn't bleep it out, they just put What the F Is That, and then like they changed the blurb to Stephen King to be fake, and it says like, you know, I don't know what the F is going on, and so they just did that, and it went all over the internet and stuff, and so Doug Cohen and I, we co-edited this together, and we previously did Oz Reimagined together, and so we just took that as the inspiration, and we just said, okay, so we're going to do a book of horror stories, and we're just going to have The only thing that people have to do in the story is they have to have some character in there at some point say what the blank is that, and they can fill in the blank with whatever they want. And we were going to do just what the F is that, but then some of the contributors was like, oh, well, I don't know if I want to be in a book with the F word on the cover, you know, and so we changed it to the Grawlix, and then that actually opened it up to sort of a more interesting idea, because then they could make it say whatever they want.
Yeah.
And they could put
they can play with it. It becomes a game.
Exactly. And they could put it in any context they want, and then, you know, when you're reading it, you don't know where it's gonna come in, and it's all types of horror stories in there. So we it's just us. It was just a lot of fun to work on, and so, you know, that's coming out in August next year. But I'm still working on it because we haven't gotten the copy edits yet, and so that's right. Still to come. So that's still in progress.
Yeah. Yeah. So getting back to the question I asked, where do you get the time?
Right. Where do I get the time? Yeah. I don't know. It's hard. I didn't think that I had time to read novels anymore, right? And then I was a judge for the National Book Award. It's like, oh, well, hello, I have to read, you know, a lot of novels for that. And so that actually opened up, like... And I didn't think I had time to do it. I also have to read all the short stories, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but it turns out I did have time, and I don't actually really understand how I did it. At this point, I'm like trying to figure out how to offload responsibilities to other people and certain things that I don't need to do. I might need to hire an assistant, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I certainly probably need to hire a bookkeeper to handle some of that stuff, because that's like the stuff that I enjoy doing least, and it takes up a lot of my time. You probably heard, the big news recently that just was announced yesterday. Houghton Mifflin brought me on as an editor at large.
No, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Oh, just announced yesterday. I'm going to be editing a science fiction fantasy line for them. So.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So we'll be doing 7 to 10.
So now you're competing with Joe Monti at Cyberpunk.
Exactly. Yeah, we are. We are. Yeah. To Joe's credit, he's my friend, and he was my agent. Used to be my agent, and he's
a former curator of the New York Times
Fiction Readers. And he's still my editor because he bought those anthologies from me. But
I forgot those were Saga.
He's been giving me advice and such, you know, because he's been doing this for a while. And so we'll be doing 7 to 10 books a year, science fiction and fantasy, and it's just going to be called John Joseph Adams Books and / HMH.
Okay. So sort of like when, Ace used to have Terry Carr presents.
And HMH actually has done this before with other people as well in other genres. So like Otto Penzler was he is the best American mystery editor,
right.
And so he also had like Otto Penzler books, and he since has moved on and taken it somewhere else because he wanted to do more books than they wanted to do, and so he took it somewhere else and he continues to do it, and it was amicable and everything, so I don't think there's any reason to not mention that, but they have done this before, and I think they did it with something in literary fiction as well, but I don't know who it was with, but that's pretty exciting.
So now that you're looking both at the long form and the short form, which do you think, what are the advantages of each?
Yeah.
Or disadvantages of each?
Right, well...
It's very difficult to make a living writing short form.
Sure, I mean, that's the primary disadvantage, I think. I mean, I think the main advantage of short fiction is that it's like this wonderful... place that you can experiment and try new things, and you can and short stories, it's a lot easier to write a perfect short story, you know, as opposed to a novel, which is like, it's almost impossible to write a perfect novel because there's just so many ways that it can go wrong, you know.
Yeah.
And with a short story you can actually possibly achieve perfection, and so I think that's definitely one benefit, and also you can produce a lot of short stories. You can keep your work out there very frequently throughout the year to remind people that you're around and that you're producing work, and so you could have a story every other month or every month, you know, depending on how prolific you are. However, I mean, there's plenty of markets these days, so it's certainly possible.
That's a whole other line of questioning I wanted to get into.
Oh,
we
yeah.
only have a little time
yeah.
left, but no,
yeah.
keep on with what
yeah.
you're saying. But I also wanted to ask about the market itself,
right.
Because it appears, thanks to online fiction,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
the market is expanding.
Yeah. No, definitely has
new
been.
New venues.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, just doing Best American, it's like, it's even larger than I had imagined. I mean, you know, I keep discovering all these different things, and it's like, anytime somebody mentions a venue, I make a note of it, and it's like, how are there still things I'm discovering? And it's not even like they just launched. It's like they were actually there and I just didn't know. And so,
and part of it may be your own fault.
Yeah.
Because as people of color mm-hmm. and queer and women and all that are discovering the anthologies you're putting out, they're being encouraged to write.
Right,
They're being told,
yeah.
you are inclusive.
Right, right.
And that means more good stuff.
Yeah.
For everybody.
Sure, and I mean, I think there's other magazines that have definitely contributed to that as well. Like, you know, like Strange Horizons is very inclusive and
Clark's
World.
And anthologies.
Yeah.
I always like to credit Cherie Renee Thomas for Dark Matter.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Who really caused more of a revolution than she realized.
Right. And, lots of different places these days are really pushing for, you know, inclusivity and diversity and everything. And so, as that continues to grow, the field continues to grow. And so there's more writers than ever.
And there's another weird place that the field is growing from that I never realized.
Yeah.
Because in one of my several interviews with Nora Jemison, to the world, N.K. Jemison,
right.
I had somehow just assumed that because she came up really, I guess, in the 90s
mm-hmm.
as starting to write
yeah.
and then became really discovered in the new millennium.
Mm-hmm.
And I somehow assumed that it was thanks to the rise of Octavia Butler mm-hmm. and finally the acknowledgement of Delaney and all mm-hmm. that. No, she came into the field because of gaming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was gaming.
Right.
And gaming people, mm-hmm. such as Tempest Bradford,
mm-hmm.
who got Nora into writing. Mm-hmm.
And yes, here we have to fade out the interview with John Joseph Adams, right as we mentioned Tempest Bradford. Well, no, that's a coincidence. Tempest is another one who left New York. But unfortunately, timing being what it was, I don't know, I back-timed it perfectly well so that the interview should have ended now. But in fact, it had another 8 minutes, and I wanted to say good night and let you know about stuff, including, by the way, KGB next Wednesday. At the KGB Fantastic Fiction, the evil opposition, the evil competition, I should say, to my wonderful New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. They have somebody really, I don't remember who it is. Google up KGB Fantastic Fiction and just go. Admission is free. It's at 85 East 4th Street. In fact, don't Google it up. Just take my word for it. Just show up. You'll have a great time because they do a wonderful job with their readings, just as I do a wonderful job with ours. And by the way, if you missed our reading last night, go to livestream.com, click on watch, search for NYRSF, and you will see John Joseph Adams. You were just listening to introducing two people from his latest anthology, The Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy, from Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And for more information on John Joseph Adams, if you dare, you go to johnjosephadams.com. Okay? It's very simple. And you'll find lots of anthologies and stuff. And Lightspeed Magazine, a podcast of which I happen to host, all available there. Let's see. Next week, a week from tonight, I should have a guest. Rajan Khanna will be here discussing Rising Tide, the second book in his series. I think the week after that should be Matt Kressel, I think. Otherwise, I better call Matt and make sure. And then on November 25th, Randy Dawn will be here. The next NYRSF reading will be with our annual event with Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. Be here because it will be a wonderful thing to enjoy. But until then, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers coming your way with Lister over these same airwaves or internet waves or whatever it is that you happen to be listening on. And this same radio station, and I'll be back next week at 1:30 a.m. In the meantime, please, everybody, be good to each other. We're human beings, and well, most of us. And oh yes, contact me. You can join the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, or the Nursef Readings group on Facebook, or just write me, Jim, J-I-M, at OurWolf.com. Have a good morning and take good care.
Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. Burn, baby, burn. ship. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one, Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
Radio station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.RG. Burn, baby, burn.
I'm taking action on the system, thinking they slick, contradicting their own, taking me for a fool. They sent my man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. Me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
But that little sweat just proves Yeah.